our lender has looked at these documents and here are the list of changes that they would like to see done so they can feel good about, you know, underwriting the collateral. So what we want to do when we're trying to do our deals is keep in mind that there's going to be somebody else who's not at the table with you that's going to look at the documents you're doing and do the best we can of anticipating what that party might want to see so that when we get that list of things we have to fix, it's shorter rather than longer. And there are a couple of different parties that I try to keep in mind when I'm doing a deal. You know, one, if I'm representing a landlord, for example, or a developer, is a buyer. You know, a buyer is ultimately going to look at this deal, right? And so sometimes if I'm doing, for example, you know, a ground lease, a retail ground lease, you know, one thing that I've noticed, and I'm curious if this is a trend or just me, is a lot of retailers now, when I say now, I mean in the last maybe 6 weeks, are coming into deals saying, I want a right of first refusal, right? Those of you who've suffered through my preferential rights presentation know that I believe that most clients and many lawyers don't really distinguish between a true right of first refusal and a right of first opportunity, but they're very different animals. And that's not the subject for this conversation. But one thing I will mention, because it's happened to me three times in the last month, is, you know, if my client, who may be the landlord and the future borrower, decides that it wants to grant a right of first refusal to get a lease done with a desirable tenant, you know, I'll say, listen, I know that I've explained to you the difference in a right of first opportunity, which is we just take a deal to somebody, they say yes or no, and then we can go on and do that deal, or a true right of first refusal where you have to actually go make and document a deal and then take those documents that you've worked on with party A, offer them to party B. That can be viewed as very disruptive by potential future buyers of the ground lease, or the landlord who's in the ground lease. They can be viewed as potentially disruptive to lenders. And so we're already kind of doing that when we document just your basic, you know, two-party deal. We're thinking about, how do we put this asset into the flow of commerce, right? How do we sell this asset once we build it and lease it? And it's a first cousin of that, as you're thinking, okay, well, before I get there, I've got to get my financing set up. And what do I think I need to be to keep in mind as we go through some of these deal points to try to minimize the difficulty we have getting the loan closed? Now, the lender card is going to be out there on every deal we do. And some people play it all the time. Some people play it judiciously. But the main thing is, first do a deal, right? Like, if we can't get a deal done, then there's nothing to finance. And I've had some situations over my career where one or more parties, hopefully not me or my client, is so worried about, or at least claims to be worried about, satisfying future nebulous lender requirements that we can't get the deal done to finance. And so what I mean by that is, if we're doing a deal and I'm representing, you know, the landlord, the borrower, not the lender, you know, I'm going to be thinking about things I need to try to get written a certain way in order to minimize the disruption when the lender comes and looks at things. But I'm not going to play that lender card overly. I'm going to play it when I need it, and I'm not going to try to disguise deal points as lender issues. I was doing a deal, it's been about 10 years ago now, but I still have PTSD from it, where we were trying to sell a portfolio of office buildings to this new fund. And I kid you not, I think they were making the notice provision a lender issue. And it became very clear to me. And finally, I was able to convince my client, listen, you know, some of these may be lender issues, but really these folks are just trying to get a better deal. And so at that point, that deal fell apart and we were able to finally find a buyer for that portfolio that was a little bit less interested in trying to use or potentially misuse the lender card. But there are things that we need to think about. The first one is easy and obvious. It's the term, it's the length of time that we have either if it's a ground lease deal, which is where you see a lot of these issues come up, you know, the term of the lease. How long has it got to be? Well, it's got to be long enough for the ground lessee to have most or all of the indicia of ownership to get the financing in place, built, and then paid off. So we have to have a term long enough that the lease is not going to end in the middle of the financing term. Now, let me make a quick caveat. If you're doing deals that have a securitization element, there are a lot of underwriting requirements. Typically, you hear, you know, 30 years beyond the loan maturity. If you're doing deals that involve securitization, you're going to get a long checklist, and it's going to be what we're talking about now times about four, right? But just in general financing terms, you know, we need a term long enough, and you can include options as long as they're unilaterally exercisable by the tenant at a rental rate that can be reasonably projected. We'll talk about that in a minute, but you need long enough in order to get the project built, stabilized, financed, and then refinanced, and then you're on your way, right? So it's going to be very hard to do significant financing if you've got a 20-year term, if you call a 20-year lease a ground lease, which sometimes, you know, retail tenants, you know, they do that. It's going to be a little bit more difficult to get that financed than it's going to be, certainly if you're doing a mixed-use project or an office building, you're going to have significantly more term to make that easy.